You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Caroline Kennedy and Eloise Klein Healy, both accomplished authors who join on stage tonight, come from quite different backgrounds. Caroline Kennedy was born to a family synonymous with American political life. She was three when her father was elected President of the United States. And many of you here tonight, myself included, remember images of her riding her pony Macaroni on the White House lawn. She was raised on the Upper East Side in Cape Cod. Eloise Klein Healy was born in El Paso, raised in small town Iowa, where her mother ran a restaurant and her father was a mechanic. She moved to Los Angeles when she was 10, where her father took a job in the special effects industry. Different as their backgrounds might be, Caroline Kennedy and Eloise Klein Healy are united in their passionate advocacy for reading, literacy, libraries, and for poetry. Caroline Kennedy, a lawyer, is the author and editor of 10 best-selling books on American history, politics, and poetry. She's active in the efforts to improve New York City's public schools and serves as president of the John F. Kennedy Foundation. She's the honorary chair for National Library Week, and her latest book is Poems to Learn by Heart, a companion to her New York Times best-selling collection, A Family of Poems. Eloise Klein Healy is the author of 7 books of poetry and 3 spoken word recordings. She's the founding editor of Arctoy Books, an imprint of Red Hen Press. And we have some Red Hen Press publishers here in the audience tonight. I want to thank them as well. Her most recent and already highly praised collection of poems is A Wild Surmise. And she was appointed this year to joyous acclaim, truly joyous acclaim, as the first poet laureate of the city of Los Angeles. So we are thrilled, of course, to present together these two talented women, both dedicated to public service and both true believers in the role of poetry. They will discuss the roles of language, imagination, and education in the development of children, and most importantly, they'll explore how a poem can inspire and challenge both the young and the young at heart. And they'll also have some help tonight from 2 young poets, Leza Duya and Nexali Orellana, both seniors at Van Nuys High School and both students of Suzanne Osman. I think she is also here in the audience. They have both participated in poetry workshops led by Red Hen Press poets. They will each read a poem selected from Caroline's anthology and then one of their own original works. Now, please join me in welcoming Caroline Kennedy and Eloise Klein Healy to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
You look like you're going on a trip. Hello, everyone. Let's give a gigantic welcome to Caroline.
Stand up again. Oh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We don't have any prizes or anything to raffle. This is just going to be a real nice discussion. I'm very happy that Caroline is here with us, and I am even more happy that you're going to be able to have a lovely conversation, some questions and answers with Caroline, and we will welcome you all into that discussion. I think it's going to be a really nice evening. So.
I hope so.
Here we go. I know that many times in interviews, you've discussed the power of literature, and you have often said that you really learned about the power of literature through your mom and from your mom. So I was wondering if you might say a little about how you learned things from her in your childhood. What was the way that came to be?
Well, I think she Sorry, that sounded incredibly loud. But anyway, I think that her love of literature and ideas and words was just something that was part of her. And so it was really integrated into our family life and our everyday life. And she would come up with, I think she grew up in a time when people had to memorize Bible verses and Shakespeare sonnets in school or for assembly. And so, and also she had, she used to go on Wednesday afternoons to have tea with her grandfather, and he, and they learned poems together. And so it was really something that I think was very important to her in terms of passing that on. And so it's one of, when I realized, when I did the Christmas anthology, I realized that, you know, while everybody else was doing cooking and things like that were really delicious and fun, we were doing poems. And so it was really, I think, though, a way of bringing reading into just everything, into holidays and into our daily life. I remember driving up the East River and seeing the barges go by, and she would quote that, you know, I think it's Robert Louis Stevenson poem, you know, Queen Kareem of Nineveh and Distant Ophir. And so she just had this endless supply, and she was the best at charades, and she had these lines of poetry that nobody could guess. And and so you always wanted her, you always wanted to be on her team. And she was just always reading, I mean, my images of her. And so that's actually how, why I did the first poetry collection that I did, because after she died, obviously there was this tremendous outpouring of people who were interested in her and admired her. And I thought that they, that the media anyway, just focused on her style and her sunglasses and her, you know, and it really wasn't what made her the person that she was. And that, more than anything, I think, was her love of reading. And I think that's something that she shared with my father. They didn't, I mean, she read history too, more biography and memoir, and he was more into sort of parliamentary proceedings. But nevertheless, I think that they both had this kind of romantic, heroic view of the past and of literature and the role that it could play in your life. And really, I think for both of them, it really set them on their life's path.
So do you think that this poetry in daily life and literature in daily life and the power of words in daily life was unique to what happened with your family as opposed to what was happening with other people?
Oh, not at all. I mean, no. I know when I went around, especially with the first anthology talking about poetry, I mean, so many people would come up to me. And, I mean, the poems in that book are a lot of old favorites. And so, but people would say that they learned this poem with their grandmother or their aunt or a special teacher. And so it really seemed much more like something that had been passed down from generation to generation and sort of had a special place in people's hearts and memories, and then had sort of fallen away as family life became maybe more fragmented or more busy. Mm-hmm. And I guess for some reason in our family, it kept going. And I've told this story, maybe some people have heard it, but we had this tradition where we had to give a poem to my mother for birthdays or Mother's Day or Christmas, and for my grandparents too. So sometimes it was something that we had written, and other times it was something that we had to pick out. And so she kept them all in this scrapbook, and I've kept it going with my own children. And so I think for them to have something that goes back to when their grandmother was a little girl is really a wonderful thing. And it just, she had a very strong sense that you should really read the great authors and the great works of literature, and that would really inspire you to dream beyond what you were maybe thinking. And so I think that was kind of her look at the world.
I think you're so very lucky, because on the way down here today, we were talking about the fact that we did not remember that when we were children, our parents were reading poetry to us. We were probably wandering around in libraries ourselves, but it wasn't the same attachment to the love of language that your family seemed to be sharing from your grandparents all the way down to your children. It's rather wonderful.
No, I feel like it's really
like
one of the
great
gifts that I've been given. And so I want to pass it on and share it. And it wasn't even that she read it. It was just something that she loved. And I think if you're a child and your parent loves something, you tend to you know, want to love it too. So it was just a really great kind of enriched, I think, our lives mm-hmm. as we went about the day.
I want to ask you a question about the collection that you put together, the best love poems of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis.
Uh-huh.
You say that you put poems that your mother wrote in the back of the book.
Okay,
special
right.
Special poems that she
right.
wrote.
And she would have hated to. I felt like she was going
to. She wouldn't rise have liked to be revealed.
Yeah, no.
Like that?
Just how could you possibly put my poem in there next to, you know, Yeats or something?
So, did you or you and your brother ever write poems?
Yeah, we wrote a few.
Uh huh.
I remember I had to write one about him.
And where are they hidden?
They are hidden. They are not going in any book. They're not going in any book.
Deep sixed.
Yeah, I guess that was my, you know.
And what about your own children? Did they write poems?
Off and on, I think. I think that they like to, you know, maybe. It's not, none of them, I think, are headed
toward
for,
that.
Toward that full time. But you never know.
Right.
You never know.
And what
my,
about?
My middle daughter translated some lines from Ovid, and so
yes.
I put those in here. And so I think she did a beautiful job. And, of course, the other two think it's just, you know, hopelessly
do you want to read a few lines
tiresome
of that one?
Of her to do be such a goody-goody. But but I got it for Christmas one year, and, of course, you know.
Do you want to read a few lines of that one?
Sure.
Okay.
Let me find it. The other two contributed poems, but my son says he hates poems. He only likes two poems. And so one of them is in the last book, and one of them is in this book, and that's it. And then this child is, you know, translating Ovid. So clearly I've had no impact on this. Scarcely had the Creator separated all things into their finite bands, when the stars began to blaze in the whole sky, which had been for so long buried in blind darkness. And so that no realm of the universe would lack life, he made the firmament to hold the bright constellations and the gods and goddesses. The waves gleamed with swimming fish. The earth had its wild beasts, the gusty air, its birds. A holier animal with a mind capable of loftier things and who could be a master over all the other creatures was still absent. So man was born. Either the Creator of all things made him from divine stock so as to found a better world, or else perhaps the new-made earth, so recently separated from the heavens, kept some essences of the familiar sky. That earth sprung from the Creator, mixed with rainwater, was molded by Prometheus into the appearance of the gods who govern all things. And while all the other animals looked down upon the earth, he made the face of man to look upon the heavens and to hold his face upward toward the stars. And so the earth, which once was crude and without form, took on the unknown shape of humankind.
Wow.
It's good, right?
Yeah.
I'll tell her she has a lot of fans out here. She'll be very happy.
That's an amazing piece.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that particular poet, no one knows what happened to him.
Oh, really?
Ovid.
Really?
Yes. He was disappeared.
Wow.
No one knows. Do any of you? No, no one does.
No.
Yes, he went from being the most incredibly gifted poet of his time to a person who disappeared because he did something that offended the government. And he was gone, either killed or exiled to somewhere far away. Yeah.
So, beware, poet laureate.
Poets always say, yeah, right, I know about that. Uh-huh. I'm being very careful. when you were working recently with children, What when you're working with children, do you feel surprises you about children when you're working on poetry with children?
Well, I guess the kids I worked with were in middle school, and It was always, it was a really funny group of kids who really didn't have that much in common. But when they would sit down and write their poems, they would just connect incredibly strongly to their sort of deeper, more emotional selves. And even though they were chattering away most of the class, paying no attention, when somebody else was sharing a poem, I think they really treated that person with great respect. And so it was really a great experience for me, the after-school poetry workshops that I worked in. And I got involved in this Dream Yard group because I've been doing work in the New York City schools, and they're one of the strongest arts education providers, and they run a lot of programs in middle schools, and then they now have their own high school. And so I asked some of the kids to help me choose poems for this book, because I wanted to make sure that I had poems that would appeal to, you know, not just old-fashioned children like me, but kids today and their younger brothers and sisters. And so one of them really liked poems about monsters, and one of them really liked fairies and dragons, and the other one liked poems about friendship and brothers and sisters and sports. So so it was fun for me to have them work on it with me. My own children would never, ever have put up with such a thing. And so so it was great. And I think for them it was interesting because they could write really incredibly long and powerful pieces and very political, but they had a lot of trouble reading and reading aloud. I don't think they had spent as much time sort of reading older texts. And so for them, it was kind of interesting. It was interesting to see them go back and forth between the two.
What do you hope for these children? What do you hope happens to them based on your interaction with them?
Well, I think what I've seen happen is that getting involved with this arts program and poetry program has really changed the trajectory of their life. And I suppose I think it did that for me, but not in as dramatic a way. And for them, their neighborhood is in the most, you know, in one of the poorest sections of the South Bronx. But I think, and some of these kids are really shy or disconnected, but they start writing in middle school, and they write about what's going on in their home or community. And I think it really empowers them and allows them to find their own voice, to get a sense of confidence. And they will tell you that. And then they keep writing, and they end up getting engaged in school. And the ones that I've worked with are all in college now. And so I think it really, they really will stay with it. And they all came back to help me with the beginning, promoting the book. And so that was really fun. But I think that it allows them to really develop the tools and the words to advocate for change. And I saw an incredible example of that when the kids had been studying their community, and they found out that the rate of HIV/AIDS in the Bronx was the same as in Africa. And so they decided that they wrote poems about it, and they wanted to have a poetry night, open mic, pizza party, and they partnered with the local hospital, and they offered testing.
Wow.
And so all their friends came, the entire high school came, and so many people were tested that night that it boosted the rate for the whole district and helped get increased funding. So it's an incredibly powerful thing that the word can do.
Really?
And I think for them to see that poetry can play that kind of a role in changing the world is really dramatic and fantastic.
I've been finding out that a lot of people care about poetry from their childhood on. You know, I've been walking around just saying, oh, I'm your poet laureate.
Really? And then what happens?
It gives me complete permission to talk to anybody. You know, last night I was saying, I talked to some cops in my neighborhood who came to check out the safety of the school and to see that everything was cool there. And I stopped them and I said, don't go away, I want to ask you about this. What?
Yeah.
What? They're a little taken aback. But I really feel that poetry does stay inside people. And there just needs to be a little encouragement, and then people do want to be engaged in a way Like people will say, oh, I wrote a poem when I was in high school, right. and I still know it. Can I recite
right.
it? And they will do that. I always feel that the poetry is just lurking there. And the very children that you were dealing with, the poetry got to escape
right.
and fill
right.
them up.
Right.
And I think a real trick is how to get people to feel that freedom,
mm-hmm.
you know, to feel
right.
that there's an allowance for the words that they have and the power that they feel. And that's a tricky part.
It's hard. And
yeah.
people are intimidated, or they say they're intimidated
right.
by poetry.
Yeah.
It makes them feel dumb. And
right.
I think
yeah.
just being a little more fearless is mm-hmm. is usually a good strategy with
yeah.
lots of things, but certainly with poetry. And also I think what you do find, and this is true mm-hmm. not just in poetry, is, you know, if you do open up and share something with people, usually they're, you know,
yeah.
they're right there
yeah.
for you. So and poetry is obviously, you
yeah.
know, allows you to share something that's really important.
Let's have a vote on that. How many of you feel that way, like you would really like to share poetry with other people? Come on, don't be shy.
Yeah, this has to be. If you guys, if you, this audience doesn't want to share poetry with people, I mean, then, like, I don't know where we should go.
They're being shy.
They're being shy.
We're not going to make you do anything.
No, yeah. Maybe we will.
Yeah.
She's ready.
Everybody turn to the person next to you
yeah,
and say a poem.
Yeah. How many people remember a poem from when they were young? So you look at that.
Mm.
And how many people have learned a poem in the last year?
Oh,
really?
Great. Whoa.
Wow.
Looks good.
Looks good. You should take them everywhere with you.
We have our poetry army.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do you view yourself as an anthologist?
Well,
your role as an anthologist? Because I see in the books that you wrote, you started off in your writing life writing about the law,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden you've escaped into the world of organizing books about poetry. What do you feel was your role there? Why did you do that?
That's a good question. There are many answers. One is that my law partner got married and moved to Maine. And and I had three small children, so
uh-huh.
I felt that I couldn't really take on a major research project. And I think that, as I said, the first poetry book really did come out of the period after my mother died. And I think for me, obviously, it was really kind of a wonderful experience to go back through her books
uh-huh.
and these childhood scrapbooks and share that. And so I guess that led me, one thing led to another. I never really intended to do this, but I had such a good time doing it, and I found that, and then I started working in the New York City public schools, and I really became, and as I was raising my own children and trying to think about how do you get kids to switch on, because as a parent, you can tell them that they should like reading, but some kids just don't, and it's hard, and they don't like to sit still, or whatever it is, or you haven't given them the right book, and so it's really a question of trying to figure that out and how to surround them with words and ideas and challenges. And so I became interested in sort of broader literacy questions. And it seemed to me that poems are these sort of capsules of, you know, the kind of emotion and feeling and experiences that kids really respond to. I mean, they deal with the big questions of life and faith and what are we doing here and all of that in a way that, as well as just being funny and silly and fun to do with your friends and all of that kind of thing. So I guess I thought, well, they're short, so kids who don't like to read just have one page to look at, not a chapter book, and they're intense and they're fun. And so I got sort of started, and then one thing kind of led to another. But I never really studied poetry, and I never really thought that I would be have put together four poetry anthologies, and somebody asked me if I was going to do another one, and I was just like, oh my gosh, I don't think so. It's gone really well so far, but I think hopefully everybody else will make their own anthologies, because I think what you find is that the poems talk to each other, and so you're just sort of sitting there in the midst of this incredible conversation between the most amazing people you could ever hope to spend, you know, an hour with, or half an hour, whatever long you spend with a poem. So so that for me has been just, I mean, it's been just the funnest set of projects. But I probably, if I write another book, I'll probably have to actually write it. I mean, people are making fun of me now.
Maybe you could write a book of poetry.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
I'm always encouraging
that. I know. Well, thank you. No, I shouldn't dismiss the idea, but it will be a while, I think.
You could send me a poem.
Okay. All right. I'll do that. Yeah, but I could send it on your... have you seen what she has in her book? This is the first person to ever do this, where she has an audio file that you can download and you can hear her reading it.
Whoa.
How cool is that?
Thanks for the ad. Can we go back to that idea about making anthologies?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. What was the difference between making the book... Wait, I'm going to pull this one out. The one I love, this one. She Walks in Beauty.
Uh-huh.
What was the different organization of this one as opposed to this one?
Well, I think the poems kind of sort themselves out in a way. They, but I guess what happened actually was that I was starting to do this, the illustrated one, and I just kept finding these incredible poems, and I thought that they really weren't anything that maybe kids would like, but I liked them, and I felt like everyone my age that I knew whose kids were grown was thinking about poetry, writing poetry again, talking about, you know, their life and how it was changing, and sort of dealing with having kind of a all those sort of thoughts and issues that come along. And so poetry was really one of the ways to find some of those answers. And so I was thinking and reading all these poems, and I thought, well, this would make a great book. And so I went to the editor, and I was like, you can't believe how many poems there are in here for women who are like, you know, middle-aged women. It's just incredible. And she said, you know, like who wants to read that? And I said, no, trust me. And so I said, I'm going to prove it to you. I am going to prove it to you. This is going to be fantastic. So, and it was really interesting because there are obvious topics like love or, you know, things like that. And then I was really thinking about how important, you know, friendship is when you have time to reconnect with some of your friends, older friends, or make new friends. And I couldn't find any poems about friendship between women, by women, about friendship with other women, and it was really perplexing to me. And one of the best things about working on that book was that I got to know some poets a bit, and so I asked them for help, and they had a really hard time too. But there's a whole lot of poets down in San Antonio. I know I didn't know you. I would have asked you because I'm sure you have a lot of friends.
I can see what's going to happen now. You're going to make me make an anthology.
What?
You're going to make
well,
me
think
make an
about
anthology.
It. I asked. I guess I had just seen Naomi. And so she has a whole community of poets down in San Antonio, which was also news to me. And they all sent me poems, and they all were very challenged by this assignment, and I said I'm gathering that poets are solitary figures, and so you must have friends. You're all very wonderful. You must have some friends. So then they all sent me these great poems, and so that was really the funnest section. But Sharon Olds also I got to know little bit, and Elizabeth Alexander. And so that was fun because it was poetry came alive in many
ways.
Which
one was your favorite of that book? Did you have a favorite?
One poem?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, because there's so many that I like.
Do you have 10 favorites?
I'm sure I have at least 10
favorites. I was wondering if I might have you volunteer to read one of them.
Sure. I can't remember which book, but... okay, let me see. Let's think about this.
I see you had Kubla Khan in that book and in this other one.
I know, I've tried not to repeat too much, but some things have to just be repeated. I memorized the Song of Wandering Angus in the 8th grade poetry contest, but I had used it in 2 books, so I couldn't use it again. I'm just looking for this. Where is it? No, Leap Before You Look. How about that?
Okay.
Oh, you've got some in here.
I did.
Okay. Well, should I read one of the ones that you like? And now I've lost it now. To be of use. Okay, sorry.
No, I'm just not wanting to make you work too hard.
Oh, okay. No, I got it now. Okay.
Okay.
Leap Before You Look by Auden.
Cool.
The sense of danger must not disappear. The way is certainly both short and steep. However gradual it looks from here, look if you like, but you will have to leap. Tough-minded men get mushy in their sleep and break the bylaws any fool can keep. It's not the convention, but the fear that has a tendency to disappear. The worried efforts of the busy heap, the dirt, the imprecision, and the beer produce a few smart wisecracks every year. Laugh if you can, but you will have to leap. Much can be said for social savoir-faire, but to rejoice when no one else is there is even harder than it is to weep. No one is watching, but you have to leap. A solitude 10,000 fathoms deep sustains the bed on which we lie, my dear. Although I love you, you will have to leap. Our dream of safety has to disappear.
Wow. Nice. Nice, yeah. How do you decide what you're not going to put in?
Well, that is really hard because that's probably why I've done 4. I could do another one.
You can't get rid of any.
Didn't get in. I know. I don't know. It's just over time.
Uh-huh.
You see how they go together, also, yeah. Maybe a little bit, and
right.
And how long they are. I mean, it's
right.
Just sort of a.
There's it's like
no.
A little symphony.
This is just what I like. So I'm just, I feel like it's so much fun to do this that hopefully other people will do it and everybody's anthology would end up with right. Some overlap, but some of their own things. I have a file on my computer with new poems that I get.
But
so.
you seem to say that it's kind of, it just happens, but I think you do a really good job.
Oh, well, thank you.
And,
well, I keep coming back to it.
Yeah.
And I keep coming back to it. And the ones for children, I try to, there's a progression. So assuming that someone actually was interested in memorizing, which is a big assumption, but they could start and build, and one would lead to
right.
Another. And so that's really the idea. And I think in this book, there was sort of a progression that I did put a lot of thought into it about kind of the tempo and the tone mm-hmm. and the mood and all of that. And
right.
And hopefully the sections would end on something that wasn't too depressing.
Yeah. I really loved that book. When that book came out, 5 of us were invited to do a reading at the Barnes & Noble store down
nice.
In Santa Monica. And we each chose a couple of poems and read from that book. And then I bought 5 copies that night to give to people because I thought it was such a wonderful anthology.
Oh, thank you.
It had, it didn't have a school-like feel to it. It had the feeling of lived experience. It was taking place over hundreds of years, So there was an old poem, and there was a poem by a living poet, and everything was all mixed up in there, but it all fit so well together. It was really great.
Oh, well, thank you.
I gave it to friends that weren't necessarily poetry lovers,
uh-huh.
but... they love the book.
Oh, good.
So,
well, that's
yeah.
great.
So
well, thank you. Thank
yeah,
you.
That's great.
that's a very great honor.
So,
thank you.
I'm going to read you a fact, and then we'll discuss this fact. With the exception of Lyndon Johnson, every Democrat since JFK and no Republican has had an inaugural poet. So, I was asking you to speculate on why you thought that would be so.
Can I tell you what I said? Can I tell them what I said?
Yeah, you can say.
I said, well, maybe there aren't any Republican poets. She said that there is an excellent one, and he's the one who picked her to be the poet laureate. So that was the end of that conversation. So,
Dana Gioia, yeah.
Well, it's interesting, though, because...
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting. I have to thank Colleen for this, because she dug up this fact
for me. Oh, she did?
Yeah.
But I also didn't know, I didn't remember who had read at Jimmy Carter's inaugurations. Uh-huh. And I was interested, I'd like to know what you thought about. I thought that the two poets who read at President Obama's two inaugurations, mm-hmm. I thought their poems were... Well, I understood the praise song sort of tradition and the daily life kind of focus of it. And so I was kind of surprised that that Richard Blanco. Did sort of a similar kind of... his poem had a similar kind of focus. It didn't go in a different... I mean, Robert Frost was a much more lofty kind of thing about America. And so I was wondering if what you thought of that.
I thought that he had some basic structural devices in that poem, moving it from sunrise to sunset, and also moving it from east to west. He picked things out that he talked about as the day progressed and the movement across the country progressed. And I thought that that was a pretty admirable understructure. Now, I know there were some people who thought, oh, that's just cheesy, he's just doing that. But I thought it really spoke well to talking about how he was experiencing the country as a span and the history of the country as a span of time. And I thought that that was a good poem. It's, you know, as we were saying before, it's not easy to write a poem for an occasion like that. It's really, you know, there you have to stand and you have to represent a gigantic country in, you know, a minute and a half. How do you do that?
Right.
So I admired him a great deal.
Yeah, me too. I thought he did a great job. I thought they both did a great job.
I wanted to jump into the question of politics and poetry. You know, you were saying you didn't think maybe there were certain people who were writing poetry or inviting a poet in to an inaugural setting. But what I'm kind of also wondering is if we live in a time in which poetic impulses seem to be being squashed a little bit, where the kind of politics that we experience in the media and also in daily life, it seems as though the kind of free exuberance is being squashed a little bit out of people. Are you...
Yeah, well, this is a grinding time. Yeah. But I also feel like, I mean, poetry is about, I mean, many things, but freedom of thought, freedom to dissent, and following your conscience, and I think that we've got so many categories and that perhaps some people don't want someone to get up at their inauguration and say what they really think. Yeah. But I think there's that great few lines from William Carlos Williams' poem about you don't read poems in the newspaper, but men die every day for lack of what is found there, meaning lack of what is found in poems. And I think that poetry really has an ability to allow us to distinguish kind of the authentic voice and the authentic information. And I think that with so much information coming at kids, that's one of the reasons why I think it is so powerful, because it it does cut through all that kind of sound bites and all of that kind of squashing of exuberance and really allow, like you said, emotion to escape and truth to escape. And so I think that that's one of the reasons why I've kept going with these anthologies and trying to sort of see if or expose kids to these kinds of to words and language used in these ways, because I think it does turn you loose to explore and with a freedom that I think now we are limiting them too much in curriculum and school and in the media. I mean, it's just everything is pretty repetitive.
Well, I think too that we're having a kind of a layering in the society of the elites and what they own and what they are allowed to have. And then as we go down and down and down, people are further removed from having access to knowledge and education.
Right.
And that...
That's why libraries are so important.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, especially offering everybody in the neighborhood a chance to have a conversation with knowledge. I think it's really wonderful. Yeah. And this building is so fabulous, isn't this room?
This is great. The best? Yeah. This is great.
Uh-huh. I love this room. Okay. I want to now ask you about the Robert Frost poem.
The one that was written. Right?
Yes, the one that was written and the one that was spoken.
Well, when I have gone back, well, we were talking about it, and I think that certainly people who watch that on TV or remember that, I mean, the poem that he couldn't see the poem that he had written for the occasion because the snow was so bright and he was old, and so he recited a poem from memory that is absolutely the most perfect poem for such an occasion that I can imagine. And so when you go back and read the poem that he composed, it just doesn't seem at all.
Yeah.
It seems like the preamble to the poem that he read. And he changed, the interesting thing about that is that it's about America, maybe many of you know The Gift outright. And then at the end, he talks about how the land was ours before we were the lands, and then we became intertwined. And then at the end, he's talking about America, and he says, such as she was, such as she would become. And then he changed it, or I guess my father asked him to, well, he couldn't have asked him. He said, such as she was, such as she will become. And so that people find is very significant because it shows that we're going to become this wonderful, even more wonderful place.
How many of you have read the poem that he actually wrote for the occasion? Uh-huh. Okay. Well, if you purchase any of these books, you can find...
Well, Eloise will come over and read it to you at your house. Put you to sleep.
Please don't give anybody any ideas. Would you? Would you not? Okay. I would like you to read the poem by James Wright. And then I, in turn, will read a response I wrote to that poem.
Oh, great.
Okay. Want to try that?
Sure.
All right. Because I believe that sometimes poets like to talk to other poets' poems, not just to other poets, but you read something and you want to start a conversation with it. And I felt... I felt I needed to talk to this particular poem.
Oh, I can't wait to hear what you said.
Okay.
A blessing. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bounds softly forth on the grass, and the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture, where they have been grazing all day, alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. At home once more, they begin munching the young tufts of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild on her forehead, and the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly I realized that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom.
It's gorgeous, isn't it? Oh, yeah. I love that poem. So the line that I was responding to was that last line.
Uh-huh.
If I stepped onto my body, I would break into blossom. This is a poem called After Having Broken Into Blossom.
Oh, wow.
There is no against, just to and fro, and where before I wondered what and why, now I shyly bend and blend into the sensible breeze. If there were anything more to say, this pink of pink of pink that I am would be answer enough.
That's great. That's great.
So now what? Are we going to have dueling poems?
Yeah, exactly. No, you reminded me, you had asked me before, and I kind of forgot how I had. But I guess the poems in that section kind of go through. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're about many things, obviously. But the year and the different seasons, and kind of there's a great poem in here, the winter poem, Winter Trees, which the poet, last night I was in Seattle, and the poet laureate of Washington State chose to read that poem. So it's been really interesting, and one of the other interesting things that I'm really looking forward to hearing are two students, is that I have tried to have students come and perform or recite either their works or anything. And I've had some of the kids from the Poetry Out Loud program, and I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a national poetry recitation contest, and it's about 6 or 7 years ago I was a judge, which is terrible because everybody's so good and they all should win. It's grown from 7,000 kids participating about 7 years ago to 375,000 kids participating and memorizing poems. And so that really made me feel like I was right.
Amazing.
That poetry is not old and fusty. It's relevant. It's people are performing it and bringing new life to older poems, as well as creating and sharing the most, you know, dynamic new poems. And I have a poem in here that the kids that I worked with wrote, which is a group poem. And I thought that that was actually a really interesting kind of new, probably isn't new, but collaborative effort. And I know that, so that's another whole dimension to this kind of rebirth of poetry.
I'm knocked out by that 350,000.
I know. And the finals is going to be at the end of April, at the end of Poetry Month. But so on my tour so far, I've seen the state champion from Massachusetts, Kansas, Missouri, and Illinois. And they're all going to be competing in Washington in a couple
Holy
of weeks.
Moly.
I know. So it's like the final four. It's going to be like... I was like, I got to go now. I didn't think I could go, but now I really want to see them. And, you know, one does a Walt Whitman poem, and one is doing a Maya Angelou poem, and one is doing... I mean, they can pick out whatever they want, and it's just fantastic, really. It's really inspiring, so... I'm sure maybe it's a podcast or something, but I don't know. Maybe the library can make it available, but it's really a terrific program.
I have to ask a question. This thing, I think, is dead. Yeah, I think so. Okay.
Well, thank you.
The first reader that will be invited up tonight is Nexali Oriana.
Hi, so I'm Nexali Oriana. And the first poem that I'm going to be reading is My Shadow by Robert Louis Stevenson. I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of him is more than I can see. He is very, very like me, from the heels up to the head, and I see him jump before me when I jump into my bed. The funniest thing about him is the way he likes to grow, not at all like proper children, which is always very slow. For he sometimes shoots up taller, like an India rubber ball, and he sometimes gets so little, there's none of him at all. He hasn't got a notion of how children ought to play, and he can only make a fool of me in every sort of way. He stays so close beside me, he's a coward, you can see. I think shame to stick to Nursie as that shadow sticks to me. But one morning, very early, before the sun was up, I rose and found the shining dew on every buttercup. But my lazy little shadow, like an errant sleepyhead, had stayed at home behind me and was fast asleep in bed. So this next poem is an original poem, and it's called Body Versus Mind. Surrounded by people, yet so alone. Lost in a crowd of my peers who say they understand me, but they don't grasp the concept of my dualities. Body versus mind. Each shouting a theory for a solution to a problem they can't even wrap their small minds around. While I'm locked in a prison. A prison that to the average person walking on the street would be a temple. Body versus mind. And as I'm screaming and shouting for a way out, all they'll ever hear is silence. Silence in the form of a smile. A smile that masks the tears, that masks the scars, that masks the weakness from the loss of blood I wish I could make stop. Body versus mind. And as I've said before, I'm surrounded by people, yet so alone. Lost in a crowd of my peers who say they understand me, but they don't grasp the concept of my dualities. And the battle is, as it always will be, body versus mind. Thank you.
And next, we're going to hear from Lisa Duya.
Good evening. My name is Lisa Duya, and I will be reading For Katrina's Sundial by Henry Van Dyke. Hours fly, flowers die. New days, new ways pass by. Love stays. Time is too slow for those who wait, too swift for those who fear, too long for those who grieve, too short for those who rejoice. But for those who love, time is not. The next poem that I will be reading is an original poem called You Are a Theme Park. You are a theme park, my sweet labyrinth of escape. You make every penny worth paying just so I'm able to go inside in your funhouse heart. The distorted mirrors in your mind reflect your most inner thoughts and memories. And I'm here, stuck in line waiting, to have a sneak peek of your candy apple kisses. Your voice is like a high-pitched scream of a 7-year-old kid. It keeps echoing in my ears, embedded to be remembered. You've been racing through my mind like the go-karts that endlessly circles around the track. And you are the first place winner to my heart. When I'm tired from wandering around the corners of your confined park, I buy your outrageously overpriced water bottles, and I am filled up again with love. The sound of the bumper cars colliding with one another mimics the thumping of my heart when you are near. I enjoy the ups and downs and the loop-de-loops of our emotional roller coaster because I know I'm able to check it off from our list of the faces we go through. And when I'm lost in the depths of the cruelty in the world, all I have to do is open up your heart like a map and find you are here. Thank you.
So, we're going to open up the floor to questions and answers.
Okay.
Okay. Anybody want to participate in the questions and answers? Oh, look, everyone's paralyzed. Yes. Oh, okay. Yes, sir.
I have a question for Caroline. It's a little bit off of the theme, but last week the LA Times wrote an editorial that suggested that you might not be qualified to be the Japanese ambassador. Could you speak to that?
Well, I don't really have anything to say about it at all, really. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
I hope this question is not too cheeky. Certainly it's different than that one. But I'll never have the opportunity to talk to two poetry scholars like I have here. So my question is, there's a poem when I was in college that was read at a college play that I will never forget, except that I can't remember who wrote it. I thought I had it in a D.H. Lawrence book at my house, and I don't. And I'm bereft that I cannot find anything on the internet. The key phrase in the poem has to do with the love that a particular woman brings to every small thing she does domestically, and it ends with a line about the love she brings to ironing a handkerchief. Does this ring a bell at all? they're saying it is D.H. Lawrence, and I can't find it in the book that I thought I had it.
Ask the librarian.
Good idea.
It's not
ring a
Tilly
bell
Olson.
With you?
What? Does no, it sounds like the Tilly Olson.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But no, I don't, can't think of. That's my first association, uh-huh. But. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
I know, but that's not a poem, right?
Question right over here.
In many ways, songs are poetry set to music. I was wondering if there was any particular song whose lyrics elevated your spirit.
There are millions.
Yeah, tons.
Yeah. Don't ask us to sing, though.
Yeah, definitely.
We've already decided we're not
right,
doing
yeah,
that.
Right, yeah, we have.
Do you have a favorite?
A favorite song?
Mm-hmm.
No, I have lots of favorite songs.
Yeah, anything that Joni Mitchell writes. Really? She's a fabulous poet.
Right. Uh-huh. That's true.
I would say I put her as the best lyricist across a whole range of types of songs and types of music that she's tried in her career. Yeah. She amazes my mind with what she's able to do. Yeah. Do you have one?
Road, Bruce uh-huh. Springsteen's Thunder Road, I always thought uh-huh. was very liberating and spoke yeah. to freedom of someone's yeah, inner good. Spirit uh-huh. being set free.
Yeah,
that's good. Good. That's really good.
Yeah.
Can either of you explain your strange affinity for Kingsley Amis?
Well, I don't even remember the book. I just remember laughing really hard, and I remember reading it out loud to my husband, and he didn't laugh at all. So, So I have to go. I want to go back. I know what it looks like, and I know where it is on the shelf in our house, and I want to go back and read it because I don't actually remember it. And after I wrote that down, I thought, God, what if this isn't funny at all? But I was so excited when Eloise said she laughed too, so and I felt like, oh, this is good.
When I read that book, I was sitting in a chair that had arms like these, and I laughed so hard I fell out of the chair over the arms. And if you recall, he would often sing, I'll be bop, bop, get you in a bop, bop, honey, be bop, bop.
Well, there's a poem for you. Yeah.
That was one of my favorite things. He's such a goof. Thank you for the question.
I think the book was Lucky Jim.
Yeah.
Yes.
I would like to mention that editorial in the LA Times has been so well rebutted by so many important people, and I think you'd be wonderful, and I hope it happens.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
Music on a printed page, if you just look at it, does not live, in my opinion. When is a poem that is not performed, does it live? And let me further that. My favorite poem is one by Allen Ginsberg. And having read it for many years, I didn't really fully understand it until I heard a recording of him performing it. And I thought to myself, I have really no right to read this out loud myself. I need to experience it from the source. So in what respect does the poem have to be understood outwardly by the poet to be understood by the person receiving it?
Go right ahead.
Well, I think that that's why. I mean, I think if you obviously, so many poems are written to be said aloud and are at their best, and certainly the oral tradition went for thousands of years, and so it's just different. I think some poems do live on the page, but many others really come to life when they're spoken or sung, like Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan or. I mean, the sound, that's one of the other things and why I tried to sort of promote memorization, even though I understand that's a scary word, because it means that you're saying it out loud and that you really know it. And so even if you're not the poet, I mean, they wrote it for you, so, and for themselves, so I assume. So, so it's still worth it, even if it's different.
I think it's important to feel that the poem belongs to you and that you can say it and that the writer can also say it, but that there is a meeting point between the writer and the reader, and that poem is passed off to the audience for either your edification or for your enjoyment. And it's, I think that that's what it's about, that it is not something that only belongs to the writer, and neither does it only belong to the reader, but I think there is that middle ground where the handoff takes place. And that's the point of value, because it is something that one person gives another and one person receives. So it's important that everybody feels they belong in it.
Right.
Uh-huh.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you both for being here. It's a great pleasure to hear you speak about poetry. My elder son is directing a spoken word concert a week from tomorrow, and he was putting together the show over the last few days with his co-directors. And almost none of the poems that the high school seniors have written rhyme at all. And it seems that rhyming in poetry has fallen out of favor. If you see that, why do you think that is? And if it hasn't fallen out of favor,
who are the poets who are writing rhyming poetry today?
Why do you keep looking at me and then you get to think of a really, really good answer while I'm blabbing on? I think that's true in some ways, although I think that a lot of times there are sort of internal rhymes, and certainly in hip-hop or rap, there's a lot of rhyming. So I think, but I have found that most of the kids that perform these poems that I've seen, their poems don't rhyme, which just makes them all the more, I think, extraordinary, because they're long and they're complex and they have lots of different tempo and rhythm in them, and people can perform and recite them just like we heard here tonight in Mind versus Body, without necessarily rhyme, but with all kinds of other devices and feeling.
I agree with her.
It wasn't until 2013 that the second largest city in the nation appointed its first poet laureate. But as we speak, the largest city in the nation has no poet laureate. Have you considered working on ending that travesty, should I say?
Well, I think I should work on it when I get home, absolutely.
Yeah, really.
I hope we can get someone as great as Heloise.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.